You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network at SevillePodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at SevillePodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up today. I'm Dan Gould. On Wednesday, June 15th, 2011, Scott Harris delivered a talk on Confederate General Thomas J. Jackson at 2nd Manassas. The 1862 action fought close to the spot where the general, in 1861, had won the nickname Stonewall. Fought as a meeting engagement on August 28th through 30th, 1862, 2nd Manassas saw Jackson's corps holding against the uncoordinated enemy assaults ordered by Union General John Pope. At 2nd Manassas, too, some of Jackson's men, temporarily out of ammunition and desperate, resorted to throwing rocks. Here's Scott Harris.
Thank you, Rick, very much. Now, can you hear me with this thing? I've got two little wireless things under here. I look like I'm packing heat, so no one get... don't want any trouble. But thank you. It is a pleasure to be back here again to speak at the Senior Center. I've had the good fortune, as Rick said, to do that a couple of times. And I am at sort of a transition point in my career, with the opportunity to actually kind of go back a little bit to earlier exploits. I'm a graduate of Mary Washington College, although now I'm employed by the University of Mary Washington. I have to get used to calling it that. But both my wife and I went there. We're very familiar with the area, and the opportunity to continue as a museum director, just with a different focus, a different time period, but in a somewhat familiar surrounding is very appealing. We'll miss the battlefield park and all that we've been doing there for the last 10 years and with many more great things to come. So I hope if you haven't been to Newmarket, you will find an opportunity to do so. Maybe get Rick to bring a group out there. I'll come along for that one and pay for my lunch and everything. So we'll try that. Now we're going to try and navigate this setup here. I'm very pleased this evening to be able to spend some time with you tonight talking about one of the true icons of the Civil War and his role in one of the most controversial and desperate battles of that war. Now, as the great philosopher Clint Eastwood once observed, man's got to know his limitations. And I must freely acknowledge, as should anyone who presumes to speak on Stonewall Jackson, my debt to the unquestioned authority on the subject, Dr. James I. Robertson at Virginia Tech. Likewise, a talk on 2nd Manassas should pay homage to the man who has written an enduring classic about the battle, Return to Bull Run, John Hennessy, historian with the National Park Service. Are either Bud or John here tonight?
I don't think so.
Good. Then I can say whatever I want. That's great. To get us to the plains of Manassas, I would like to actually first go back a bit in time in the chronology of Thomas Jonathan Jackson and try to answer a couple of questions. What were the circumstances of this man's upbringing? And who was he? This man who rose from the humblest of beginnings, endured repeated personal loss, and through fervent religious faith and iron determination, forged a life and career that became legendary. Well, in order to get ourselves to Manassas in August of 1862, let's start a little further back, traveling on that road with Thomas Jackson for a while. He was born on January 21st, 1824, in Clarksburg, Virginia, now West Virginia, the third child of Julia Beckwith Neal Jackson and Jonathan Jackson, an attorney. By the time he was 7 years old, Jackson was an orphan living with various relatives. He and his younger sister, Laura Ann, stayed longest with their uncle, Cummings Jackson, at his mill in Lewis County, West Virginia. Young Tom worked a variety of jobs around the mill and received a rudimentary education. It is said that he made a deal with one of his uncle's slaves to get pine knots in exchange for reading lessons. Tom would study at night by the light of the pine knots and did teach the slave to read, a precursor of similar activities he would pursue later in life. With limited financial resources and few options available for higher education, Jackson managed to secure an appointment to the United States Military Academy at West Point in 1842 from Congressman Samuel L. Hayes, to whom young Tom was related by marriage. The appointment occurred only after the congressman's first choice, an acquaintance of Jackson's named Gibson Butcher, abruptly left the point after a single day there. Took one look, said, "This is not for me." But that little accident of fate opened up the opportunity for Thomas Jackson to go to West Point. Being less prepared academically than most of his peers, Jackson began at the bottom of his class. Showing the dogged determination that would carry him through the rest of his life, he steadily improved each year. He graduated 17th out of a class of 59 cadets in 1846. Many believe that the course of study had lasted one more year, he would have been at the top of his class. The West Point class of 46 is called the class that stars fell on, producing 12 Union and 10 Confederate generals. Jackson would fight with and against a dozen of his classmates during the war. He began his Army career as a second lieutenant in the 1st U.S. Artillery Regiment and was sent to fight in the Mexican-American War from 1846 to 1848. Served at the Siege of Veracruz and the battles of Contreras, Chapultepec, and Mexico City, and eventually earned two brevet promotions and the regular Army rank of first lieutenant. Jackson and I have spoken in other venues about Jackson's career in Mexico, and I'm shortening it a bit this evening, but it's a fascinating little moment in time because it starts to show some of those character traits of rigid discipline, of the willingness to take a gamble on a bold move, the willingness to sometimes be very casual about orders when he thought that the situation called for it, and yet always with this sense of very great personal bravery that we really don't think as much about with Jackson, but he risked himself repeatedly through the war in odd ways. And it really started there in Mexico when he put himself very much on the front lines where artillery normally aren't. He liked to be where the action was up front. This forward thinking got him a commendation from the Army commander, General Winfield Scott. And in fact, Jackson, in the Mexican War, earned more promotions than any other officer who served in the United States Army during that conflict. The end of hostilities in Mexico brought occupation duty for Jackson, during which he developed a lifelong fondness for the Spanish language and culture. He even considered moving to Mexico and living there permanently. Instead, he remained in the Army and served in both New York and Florida for the next 3 years. It was at Fort Meade, Florida, that Jackson became embroiled in a conflict over protocol with his superior, Captain Benjamin French, seen here later in life as a Union general. A controversy that went all the way to the commanding general of the Army, who wished the whole thing would just go away. Both men shared some measure of blame for the situation, but Jackson's pride and certainty of being right, compounded with the relative boredom of peacetime Army life, spurred his desire for change. The opportunity for a new start came in the spring of 1851, when Jackson joined the faculty of the Virginia Military Institute in Lexington. Established in 1839 under Superintendent Francis H. Smith, VMI was the first state-supported military school in the nation. Jackson was professor of natural and experimental philosophy, an emerging discipline that would eventually be called physics. Covered a wide range of physical, mechanical properties of matter, optics, a number of different things. And Jackson's stiff teaching style, combined with his extreme piety and harsh discipline, made him not only unpopular with cadets, but the subject of open ridicule. His other role, though, at VMI was as instructor of artillery. And here he was within a more natural and comfortable element, and his war record as an artilleryman gave him an unquestioned credibility. I was crossing this out, but I'm going to go ahead and read this quote because this is really good. A member of the VMI class of 1861 recalled the effect of artillery drill on Jackson's normally reserved personality. As soon as the sound of the guns would fall upon his ears, a change would come over Major Jackson. He would grow more erect. The grasp upon his saber would tighten. The quiet eyes would flash. The large nostrils would dilate. And the calm, grave face would glow with the proud spirit of the warrior. The cadets, who moved the heavy guns without the aid of horses, did not always share Jackson's enthusiasm, but it certainly got his blood going. Jackson's desire for a stable domestic life in Lexington seemed fulfilled in 1853 when he married Eleanor Ellie Junkin, daughter of the president of Washington College. Their happiness was short-lived. Ellie died the following year from a hemorrhage soon after giving birth to a stillborn son. 1857, Jackson married Mary Anna Morrison of North Carolina. Her father, ironically, was also president of a college, Davidson, in her native state. The Jacksons would have two daughters, Mary, who died at the age of 1 month in 1858, and Julia, born in November 1862. The Jacksons bought this modest brick home on Washington Street in 1858. And while it was intended to be a transitional dwelling until something more substantial could be acquired, this would be the only home that Thomas Jackson would ever own. And as some of you may know, the Stonewall Jackson House has very recently become part of the VMI Museum Operations Department, to which the Newmarket facility also belongs. So we've got a big, new, diverse, happy family that we're putting together with those two sites as well as Newmarket. Oh, don't want to do that. Let's try that. Family and home life also solidified Jackson's involvement with the Presbyterian Church in Lexington. Though baptized as an Episcopalian in 1849, he made the rounds of Lexington's five churches, two Methodist, one Baptist, one Episcopal, one Presbyterian, with an open mind. Jackson was impressed with the simplicity of worship and the well-educated ministry of the Lexington Presbyterian Church, which he joined in 1851. Later years, he founded a Sunday school for the town's slaves with the help of John T.L. Preston, a distinguished VMI colleague. As many as 100 African Americans gathered at the church each Sunday afternoon when Jackson was present. Attendance fell off dramatically when he was gone, which to me suggests he was a little better at religious education than he was at natural philosophy or artillery tactics. And as many of you are probably familiar, even as he went off to war, fighting for the Confederacy, fighting for, certainly in one aspect, the preservation of slavery or the preservation of the possibility of slavery, he continued to support the Sunday school, sending contributions back throughout the rest of his life. Oh, and I'm sorry, I had a couple of slides relative to that there. The growing sectional controversy over the extension and existence of slavery struck close to home with John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry in October of 1859. Jackson led the VMI cadets to Charlestown to act as guards for Brown's hanging on December 2nd. Now, he is possibly the leftmost mounted officer in this engraving, though he, I am certain, did not wear a plumed hat then or ever. Maybe Jeb Stuart, the uniform he gave him, I don't know. Tensions escalated with Abraham Lincoln's election as president the following year. The firing on Fort Sumter and South Carolina's secession soon followed. By April 1861, Virginia faced the choice of staying in the Union or joining the Confederacy. Like Robert E. Lee and other Virginians who had served in the U.S. Army, Jackson was not an ardent secessionist. However, also like Lee, he would not draw his sword against his native state. When Lincoln called for 75,000 volunteers to put down the rebellion, Virginia seceded on April 17, 1861. 4 days later, Jackson and the Corps of Cadets set out for Richmond to train recruits flocking to the Capitol. On April 26, he was commissioned a colonel of Virginia volunteers. Events progressed rapidly in that first spring of the war. Jackson occupied Harper's Ferry, disrupted the B&O Railroad, and in late May took command of the 1st Virginia Brigade. Expecting Union invasion any day, the Confederates under General P.G.T. Beauregard fortified Manassas Junction, and Jackson's brigade arrived from the valley with the rest of General Joseph E. Johnston's reinforcements on July 19th. As the battle reached its climax on July 21st, 1861, troops from Georgia, Mississippi, and South Carolina reaching the summit of Henry House Hill encountered Brigadier General Jackson, so I can get him there, and his 1st Brigade and 9 pieces of artillery arrayed in a formidable defensive line. South Carolina General Bernard Bee approached Jackson, who was seated calmly on his horse, and exclaimed, "The enemy are driving us." To this, Jackson replied, "Then, sir, we will give them the bayonet." Exhorting his own troops to reform, Bee then inadvertently coined one of the most famous nicknames in American history. "There is Jackson standing like a stone wall. Let us determine to die here and we will conquer. Rally behind the Virginians." Or something like that. A lot of argument about that. That's what Bud Robertson says he said, so I believe that. I'll take that. Jackson, his blood boiling, even as it dripped from a finger wound, mini ball, clipping his finger, exhorted his men to, quote, reserve your fire until they come within 50 yards. Then fire and give them the bayonet. And when you charge, yell like furies. If anyone needs to know the organic origins of the rebel yell, that's it right there. First Manassas created the legend of Stonewall Jackson and the brigade that shared his nickname. For the next year, he would be a greater celebrity in the South and the North than any other Confederate general, and most of the Union ones too. Jackson's military exploits during the next 17 months included low and high points. An indecisive campaign in West Virginia and defeat at Kernstown in March 1862 were followed by brilliant successes in the Valley campaign, culminating in the twin victories at Cross Keys and Port Republic in June. Jackson's apparent lethargy during the 7 days battles around Richmond yielded mixed results, but it did not shake the confidence placed in him by Robert E. Lee, who assumed command of the Army of Northern Virginia when Joe Johnston was wounded. With McClellan slowly retreating back toward Washington in the failed attempt to take Richmond in his Peninsula campaign, Abraham Lincoln placed Major General John Pope in charge of a hastily assembled Army of Virginia. Pope was pompous in manner and distrustful of McClellan and the officers who were loyal to him, and rightfully so, as it turned out. With McDowell as his senior subordinate, Pope moved out from Washington to the Rappahannock River, intent on drawing Lee into a battle of annihilation before taking Richmond himself. Lee's army of about 55,000 was divided into two wings, one commanded by Jackson, the other by James Longstreet. While a formidable force, the Army of Northern Virginia would be vastly outnumbered if the armies of Pope and McClellan could combine. And so the strategy was going to be to take decisive action before that combination could occur. Thus began the Northern Virginia campaign that would consume much of August 1862. Union hopes of victory would be dashed by Lee's boldness, Jackson's speed, and Longstreet's determination, as well as Pope's incompetence. Pope probed the Confederate position near Gordonsville with Major General Nathaniel P. Banks' Corps on August 9th. After initial success, a Confederate counterattack by A.P. Hill repulsed the Federals and won the day. This is at Cedar Mountain. Lee now took the initiative to move rapidly against Pope before he could be reinforced by McClellan's Army of the Potomac. With 24,000 men, Jackson made a wide flanking march north and east via Thoroughfare Gap that brought him to Bristow Station in Prince William County on August 26, 1862. After surprising and derailing a few trains, the Army moved to Manassas Junction, which had become a major Federal supply depot. An orgy of pillage and destruction followed, and if you read the accounts of the soldiers that saw this huge stockpile of Union material, not just arms and ammunition, not just blankets, but canned hams and oysters and desiccated vegetables and champagne and cigars and champagne, it was just wondrous. And there's only one sketch of it that's ever done. I think it was in Battles and Leaders. I have it there. You can't really tell, but I think the mounted fellow's got chickens hanging off of his horse. It was just amazing. And of course, they could only take a fraction of it. The rest of it was burned. Jackson then withdrew to the old battlefield near Bull Run, and he found a shelter within an abandoned, unfinished railroad grade cutting through a hill that would become known as the Deep Cut, a perfect defensive trench, really, with which to position himself to make trouble out there around the place where he had been making trouble just a year before. And here Jackson awaited word of Longstreet's passage through Thoroughfare Gap. Now, it's a mistake to think that having taken off on this march that Jackson and Lee are just totally cut off from each other. That's not the case. Cavalry couriers, the Black Horse Troop particularly, were employed throughout this entire campaign to keep contact between Lee and Jackson. And so really, there was a pretty steady flow of information coming from both directions, with these riders riding, I think, about a 50-mile stretch each, in a way that kept things going very easily for the army. They were not just off on their own and totally out of sight with no idea of where Jackson was going. Longstreet, with the other wing of Lee's army, forced his way through Thoroughfare Gap on August 28th, thereby ensuring the eventual reunion of the two wings of Lee's Army of Northern Virginia. Knowing from those couriers I mentioned that Longstreet was on his way and wanting to keep Pope from moving east toward McClellan, Jackson decided to attack a Union column moving in front of him on the Brawner Farm at Groveton on August 28th. After observing the Union troops for some time in plain view while sitting on his horse, Jackson calmly turned to his returned to his lines and addressed his commanders. "Bring out your men, gentlemen." As Confederate artillery opened up on the Yankees, the brigades of Alexander Lawton and Isaac Trimble slammed into those of John Gibbon and Abner Doubleday, who did not invent baseball. The battle grew in intensity as more troops were committed. Major Rufus R. Dawes of the 6th Wisconsin remembered it thus: "Our men on the left loaded and fired with the energy of madmen, and the 6th worked with equal desperation. This stopped the rush of the enemy, and they halted and fired upon us their deadly musketry. During a few awful moments, I could see by the lurid light of the powder flashes the whole of both lines. The two were within 50 yards of each other, pouring musketry into each other as fast as men could load and shoot." If you know anything about Civil War arms, 50 yards is nothing. The power of a rifle musket by that point, nobody could miss at 50 yards. The hard fighting also aroused Jackson's martial spirit. And he said, "In a few moments, our entire line was engaged in a fierce and sanguinary struggle with the enemy. As one line was repulsed, another took its place and pressed forward as if determined by force of numbers and fury of assault to drive us from our positions." He was quite pleased with what was going on. This was Jackson in his element. Now, this actually is from the Union main base at Centerville, Virginia, about 7 or 8 miles away, period drawing showing that they could see what was going on over there. There was definite awareness that somebody was out there west of Centerville, out there in the direction of Manassas, and that fight at Groveton was the first indication. And that's part of Jackson's plan. He wants Pope's attention out there. He does not want Pope falling back to link up with McClellan. If there's any one order that Jackson's operating under at this point, one driving strategy, it's keep those armies from reuniting. As Jackson dug in at Stony Ridge north of the Warrenton Turnpike, Pope ordered attacks on both of Jackson's flanks. Major General Fitzjohn Porter's troops ended up marching in the wrong direction, but Major General Franz Sigel's corps struck A.P. Hill, A.P. Hill's division, at 7 a.m. on August 29th. There's General Sigel. The brigades of Generals Maxie Gregg and Edward Thomas on the Confederate side received the attack from Union troops led by a rather international cast of Sigel, of course, a German immigrant who would be the commander at the Battle of New Market a few years later. The division he sent in was commanded by a German, Carl Schurz, a Republican activist, both before and after the war. Those two brigades under Schurz consisted of one commanded by a fellow German, Alexander Schimmelpfennig, and I'm building up to the last one, the brigade commanded by the native of Poland, Wolzimierz Krzyżanowski. I practiced that for days. Jackson's aggressive defense of Stony Ridge succeeded in keeping Pope's attention. Whoops, I'm sorry, I forgot about Krzyżanowski there.
That's Krzyżanowski.
I'm sorry, that's Schimmelpfennig is the one second from the bottom, and then Krzyżanowski is the one at the bottom. Unfortunately, they're a little small for this distance there, but Jackson's aggressive defense of Stony Ridge succeeded in keeping Pope's attention on him, despite mounting evidence that the rest of Lee's army was approaching from the west. Pope seems to have been unable to accept the hard intelligence, even from trusted subordinates, that conflicted with his own view of the situation. By noon on August 29th, Longstreet's wing had taken positions at roughly a right angle to Jackson's line. Lee wanted to attack immediately, but he was convinced by Longstreet that caution was called for. Pope's orders to McDowell and Porter at this point, which first indicated an advance against Jackson, concluded with the possibility of falling back to Centerville. And at the end of the order, he basically left it up to the commanders on the field to disregard his orders if they thought it was a good idea, which pretty much made it a useless order from start to finish. It said a lot without really telling them anything. The order never explicitly told McDowell and Porter to attack Jackson, though in his mind, Pope believed that he had. Pope ordered four separate attacks against Jackson's line to divert attention from the attack by Porter that he expected at any minute. First in was Brigadier General Cuvier Grover's brigade, followed by that of John Reynolds, James Nagel, and the one-armed Stephen Kearny, famous for his Mexican War exploits. Kearny's attack almost rolled up Jackson's line. You got to remember, these guys have been marching and fighting for several days straight now, coming off that very fatiguing seven days battle, which in itself was succeeding the Valley campaign. I mean, they have been some tired guys, have marched an incredible distance. They've been in constant combat for a couple of days. And Kearny, had he pushed it a little harder, might well have rolled up Jackson's line right there and given Pope the victory that he wanted so badly. But Confederate counterattacks stopped Kearny from being able to destroy Jackson's line. The continued Union attention paid to Jackson's position finally convinced the cautious Longstreet to agree to Lee's desire to attack. Hood's division, that John Bell Hood, took his division forward just as a federal division under John Hatch moved west on the Warrenton Turnpike. He had been sent by Pope to pursue the retreating Confederates. The short, sharp fight, coming as darkness fell, made Longstreet cautious again. Little did he and Lee know that Pope, while now acknowledging Longstreet's presence on the field, still believed he was only there to protect a general Confederate withdrawal. Pope's belief was reinforced on the morning of August 30th, because Porter was finally in position for the attack that Pope had wanted, though he had never ordered, during the day before. At dawn, the Confederate division of Major General Richard Anderson, which had arrived overnight, got about 3 in the morning, they stumbled into camp. We didn't really know where they were exactly. When they woke up, they realized they were very close to the enemy. They had positioned themselves way ahead of their own troops. So they pulled back to the Confederate line. Well, Pope goes, there, see? They're retreating. Good news. Despite the fact that several other reports were coming in from his cavalry and others saying, look, Longstreet's here and he's not leaving, he is just arriving. Pope ordered Porter to go ahead and attack. Go ahead and make that attack that he's wanted since yesterday, supported by brigades of Hatch and Reynolds. The divisions of Kearny, James Ricketts, and Joseph Hooker would attack on the Union right. Longstreet, however, was not retreating. His 25,000 men were dug in and ready, and Lee had also placed 18 pieces of artillery on high ground northeast of the Bronner Farm to bombard the open fields in front of Jackson. Now, the assault on Jackson's position put enormous strain on his exhausted troops, who were literally now running out of ammunition, or very low. But in fact, a couple of regiments did run out, prompting what is arguably the most famous incident of this battle, throwing rocks at the attacking Yankees, some of whom were so shocked and surprised they picked them up and threw them back. They had ammunition, but something, the little boy in them said, oh, no, you don't. Porter's attack on Jackson's right caused significant Union casualties, which were made worse by his failure to use his reserve troops. He had Sykes regulars, regular U.S. Army troops there as a reserve, but he didn't put them in. And so it left his lead brigades to extricate themselves from the field without any real support. Jackson's ranks were too depleted to mount an effective counterattack, and so the time for Longstreet's attack now had finally come. At 4 p.m., Longstreet's five divisions, 25,000 men in a line stretching nearly a mile and a half across, moved against the Federal left. Only two brigades, led by Colonels Nathan McLean and Gouverneur Kay Warren, were in position to try and stop the Confederate advance. And stop it they could not, but they could slow it down. Although devastated, they held on long enough for Pope and McDowell to organize a new defensive line on Henry House Hill, an ironic replay of the Confederates' use of that same hill during the First Battle of Manassas. Some of Longstreet's divisions became misaligned as the attack went forward, providing just enough breaks in fire to give Pope time to solidify his position on Henry House Hill. McLean's role with his Ohio brigade helping with that as well. Confederate attacks on Chinn Ridge, though ultimately successful, also cost men and time, slowing up this Confederate attack somewhat. On the Union side, at about this point, one of the notable casualties was the son of Daniel Webster, Colonel Fletcher Webster. By this point, just before 6 p.m., Robert E. Lee had committed his entire army to battle. John Pope, who had finally come to the realization of just how much danger he was in, was now seeking only to save as much of his army as he could. And they had musical accompaniment while they were doing it. Jackson attacked north of the turnpike at about 6 p.m. in support of Longstreet, but with little vigor or effect. Again, this was possibly due to the debilitated condition of his men, or even really of the general himself. By 8 p.m., with a strong rear guard in place and darkness approaching, Pope ordered a general withdrawal to Centerville. Among the conclusions drawn from 2nd Manassas were the failure of Pope to accurately assess his enemy's position and intentions, his inability to accept intelligence that contradicted with his own view of the conditions, and his ambiguous orders to his subordinates, especially Fitzjohn Porter. On the other hand, Pope's belief that Porter and other McClellan supporters in the Army of the Potomac would rejoice at his failure was somewhat correct. Letters and other documents have shown that sentiment. Now, whether that means that Porter was purposely trying to perform badly to cause Pope to lose, that's probably a bit extreme. But Pope certainly believed it, and he saw that Porter was disciplined, court-martialed, and then Fitzjohn Porter would spend nearly two decades trying to regain his military reputation and honor after the censure he received in the wake of 2nd Manassas. This battle gave Lee the initiative, inspiring him to take the war into Northern Territory for the first time, and Jackson would again lead the way. The Battle of Antietam in September 1862 ended the first Confederate invasion of Northern Territory. Here, as during the 7 days, Jackson faced his old West Point classmate, George McClellan. But December 1862 closed with the repulse of Ambrose Burnside's Army of the Potomac at Fredericksburg, where Jackson was again in the thick of the fighting in December in Fredericksburg. On May 2nd, 1863, at the end of the first day's fighting at the Battle of Chancellorsville, Jackson was wounded by his own men as he scouted between the lines for a possible night attack. Jeb Stuart commanded Jackson's Second Corps the next day as Robert E. Lee and the Army of Northern Virginia once again routed the Army of the Potomac, this time under General Joseph Hooker. It is regarded as Lee's greatest triumph, but came at an irreplaceable cost. Jackson was hit by one musket ball in the right hand and two in the left arm, requiring its amputation. Lee lamented that while Jackson had lost his left arm, he, Lee, had lost his right. Hopes for Jackson's recovery faded as pneumonia set in. With his wife by his side, though she's not shown here, he slipped into delirium, issuing orders to A.P. Hill, among others. Finally, in a clear, calm voice, he said, "Let us cross over the river and rest under the shade of the trees." At 3:15 on May 10th, 1863, Thomas Jonathan Jackson died. Mighty Stonewall, the pious warrior who had always kept the Sabbath holy, yet fought many battles on it, had his last wish fulfilled by dying on a Sunday. Franklin Wright, a Union private from Massachusetts, writing to his mother about the news of Jackson's death, said simply, "We shall fear him no more." After lying in state in Richmond, Jackson's remains were transported to Lexington, where he was buried on May 15, 1863. Over the years, the grave would become a place of pilgrimage for family and friends, old soldiers, and the merely curious. In homage to Jackson's most famous apocryphal habit, lemons are always scattered around the ground. It's another one Bud Robertson kind of goes, about, but, why clutter the issue with facts? Stonewall Jackson's legacy endures today not only in history books, but in a plethora of images from monumental to commercial. Where can I get me some of that Stonewall Jackson canned salmon? That's what I want to know. Love that. The Jackson story, we're resuming the commercial part of the broadcast now. The Jackson story is best told at the Virginia Military Institute Museum, housed appropriately in Jackson Memorial Hall. Here you will find artifacts such as the raincoat he was wearing when shot at Chancellorsville and lovingly preserved the general's plain but sturdy war horse, Little Sorrel. And as I mentioned, now with the Stonewall Jackson House incorporated into our museum operations, we think there's going to be a lot of opportunity for more promotion, more awareness of all these sites, and Jackson provides a link. Even in Newmarket, although he was not at the Battle of Newmarket, Jackson's presence in the valley, the fact that we do interpret a wider Civil War story there than just the Battle of Newmarket, it's really going to be a great synergy there. Well, in closing, I want to thank you for asking me to speak to you tonight on 2nd Manassas and for accompanying me on this journey through the remarkable life and unforgettable legacy of Stonewall Jackson. Thank you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.